Thanks, Shelley. And I want to start by just expressing how much fun I've had at this meeting, despite having appendicitis when I landed here. This is just sort of a scientific paradise. I've never been to this meeting before, but yeah, just having so many people with diverse backgrounds, but a shared scientific passion come together and have discussions like have occurred here over the last few weeks has been fabulous, and I look forward to being a part of that. So thanks to Mike and Shelley and Rob and Hernan and everyone else at KITP who's contributed to organizing and propagating this atmosphere. I should say, when I started a faculty job, I was really thrilled by my first faculty meeting. I was really looking for, I was thrilled by the perspective of it. And sort of this is what I anticipated. People were going to be talking about you know, rich scientific dialogues. No. So the first faculty meeting was actually the most tedious one I've ever been to. It was about how parking was changing, and it was literally one person after the next saying, well, where's my spot going to be? Anyway. It's true. I mean, the truth shall set you free. All right, so a lot of my interests are molecularly based. That's where my training lies. And so being here, in particular, I've learned a tremendous amount of cell biology and how to start to connect those ideas to molecular ideas as well. So I'm going to tell you about some experiments we've been doing where at least the things I'll tell you about today are really focused on purifying selection. So this is really, I know, not necessary in this particular audience from seeing the amount of questions, but they're very, very welcome. I'm happy to discuss any topic in more detail. So if you see something that's confusing, please let me know. If you see something you dislike, and those from New England may see where sort of this line of pictures are going. Of course, also, if you see something that you really enjoy, also, you know, give a shout out. Okay, so purifying selection is the depletion or removal of a mutation or an allele from populations because that allele has a lower fitness than the average population. So there's lots of different models of evolution. Neo-Darwin sort of proposed that there's two real categories, deleterious and beneficial. Of course, much more modern studies have shown really, I think, quite nicely that there's lots of evolution that's non-adaptive, that's neutral in nature, from sort of a mutation that has absolutely zero effect, which is sort of pure neutral, from Kimura to Oda's realization that there's a window of fitness effects that are going to be subject primarily to accumulation or depletion due to drift, due to random processes. And that window, as Mike and others here have really beautifully shown, is inversely proportional to the effective population size. Okay, so regardless of that, there's complete agreement among all these models that the vast majority, at least in protein coding sequences, the vast majority of amino acid substitutions are going to be deleterious. And so I think there's that in itself provides a large rationale and motivation for trying to understand why those mutations are deleterious. So I'd like to, you know, this may be apparent to all of you, but just to go over sort of the main points or the main observations that really demonstrate that most mutations are deleterious. And it really comes from observations that if you look at two species that have diverged, they tend to accumulate in protein coding regions lots of synonymous substitutions, but very few amino acid changing substitutions. So the basic idea there is that the silent substitutions are going to be neutral. They're going to accumulate by drift. If there are other neutral mutations that change the amino acid sequence, they should also accumulate by drift. So if you see predominantly silent substitutions and very few amino acid changing substitutions, that's a strong evidence that most amino acid changing substitutions are deleterious. Okay, and so that's in fact quite true. There's initial early genome sequencing of different yeast species showed that the ratio of non-synonymous to synonymous changes between yeast species was about 10 to 1, so 10 synonymous substitutions for every one amino acid changing. Okay, so over evolutionary timescales are long timescales. As Shelley really, I think, eloquently put to me the other day, evolution has basically done a large-scale mutation experiment. And every single nucleotide substitution is essentially going to have been sampled by populations over these long timescales. So if you don't have very many amino acid changes, that's very strong evidence that they're deleterious, but it also doesn't give you much inference into how deleterious each of these amino acid changes might be. So people have looked in a lot of detail about how different proteins, how their amino acid sequence changes. And so the evolutionary rate, the rate of accumulation of non-synonymous to synonymous mutations varies by a tremendous amount. There are a fair number of proteins that are almost fixed, and their amino acid sequence doesn't change virtually at all, despite the accumulation of synonymous substitutions. And there are also a large tail with proteins whose amino acids, you get about one amino acid changing mutation for every two synonymous changes. Okay. So there's been a lot of efforts by many different groups to understand what are some of the biochemical or biophysical or genetic features that may explain some of this variation in the rate of protein evolution. Some of the earlier analyses had to do with the fitness effect of null alleles. So if a protein is essential, perhaps it has a slower evolutionary rate than proteins that are not essential. There is a correlation here that's statistically significant if you have a large number of proteins you look at, but it doesn't describe a lot of the variation in the rate of protein evolution. So the R squared is about 5%. The same thing also applies to protein interaction density. So some models from the 70s from Zucker, Candle, as well as others, suggested that if you're a protein that interacts with a lot of other proteins, you're going to be slow to evolve because you have to maintain all of these protein interactions, and that comes with constraints. When two hybrid technology became amenable to look at genome-wide interactions, this is one study that showed correlation between, I think this is yeast and flies, but the number of interactions, at least by two hybrid at a gene scale, also shows a correlation. If you have more interactions, you tend to evolve slower, but it doesn't explain a lot of the variance. Again, it's only about a 5% R squared. By far, the strongest correlation that people have observed is with expression level. So the mRNA, the copies of mRNA of a gene in yeast, for example, describe about 50% of the variance in the evolutionary rate of the proteins. So this seems to be very robust. Multiple different groups have reported this by using different data sets. Okay.
Dan, do you think there's a correlation between expression level of the gene and the number of interactions that's involved in it? So which would make the interpretation of those last two graphs a bit difficult?
Yeah, no, I think that all of these potential contributors to evolutionary rate are not necessarily independent. And the interdependencies, there are a few studies that have tried to deconvolute them. I think there's a really nice one from Jesse Bloom, where, for example, he's looked at more energetic consequences and trying to discern hydrophobic from polar interactions. It's a little bit difficult. There are things do co-vary, but I think that I would still say that the strongest correlation is going to be indicative, more indicative of what may be a driving force. So even if these two things are correlated, if interaction density is only explaining 5% of the variance, and expression level is explaining 50%, I would say that the expression level is a more meaningful place to think about. Yeah, so I don't know, I haven't followed the most recent updates of this type of analysis, but mRNA and protein levels correlate roughly. So the protein expression level has actually a similar pattern. I don't know if it's slightly more, the correlation coefficient slightly higher or slightly lower. Okay, so people have also thought, I think, in a really coherent way about why expression level correlates with evolutionary rate. And I'm going to show only two sort of two vignettes of what people have thought about this. One is expression cost and benefit trade-offs. So this is a really elegant model, I think, from Gout and Duray. And the notion there is that if you have a highly expressed protein, independent of what the expression level of the protein is, there's the ability to change the expression level as well as the activity or biochemical properties of the protein through amino acid changes. So those two things can be in have trade-offs. So for example, if you have a mutation in a promoter region of a protein that's expressed at a low level, that sort of, let's say you have a protein that's at 100 copies per cell, you have a promoter change and now it's at 200 copies per cell. This is a relatively small cost of expression. You're only making 100 more molecules, but it now gives you, if it's an enzyme, for example, you can reduce the turnover number of that enzyme by twofold. You can tolerate mutations that do that, and you're going to be at the same net flux. So it gives you a very small cost to changing the function for proteins that are at a low expression level. In contrast, if you had a protein that was at 100,000 copies per cell, and you changed the promoter mutation accumulated that now made it express 200,000 copies per cell, you're paying a much higher expression cost. And so you're going to have a much steeper trade-off if you try to think about how that protein would drift in evolution. So if you guys are interested in that, I'd be happy to talk further. The paper, I think, is a really nice and clear description of that idea. So basically, what happens if you have a low expression protein, the expression rate relative to the optimum is very steep, which means you have strong selection. If you have a low expressing protein, it's very broad, which means that there's going to be a lot more opportunities to drift.
What about proteins where if you change the expression level, you actually change the function of your biological system?
Yeah, no, that's a fabulous point. So there's lots of exceptions to all these. These make assumptions about protein function, and there's going to be lots of exceptions to them. And the one you note is absolutely one. So if you had a protein that, for example, oligomerized, and it was functional in the monomer form, but not the oligomer, and you increase expression level, you've got much more complicated selection regimes. Yeah. So this is thinking about a simplified system, if you will, monomeric protein, no concentration dependent terms. Yeah.
When does RNA editing fit into this scheme? Because we know that there's a bias, there's a subclass of proteins that are going to be subject to editing, and editing is going to be a mechanism to increase diversity or error, whatever you want to call it. I've actually never tried to put the two together in my mind, but now you're talking about translation error, so it's the same category, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. So I don't know precisely how to think about RNA editing, but I think that one potential would be if the consequences of the edited and non-edited have different effects, and they're proportional to the expression level, you'd expect to say you might see a pressure to have more or less editing on a higher expressed or lowly expressed gene. There may be an expression level component to it, I would say. I'm not sure if that's what you were thinking. You're looking confused.
I suddenly realized that editing would fit in the same category as translation error, since it generates diversity. And if that's something that you need to take into account when you consider expression levels, and then there is a bias, whereas translation error is a generic thing that affects any protein. Editing is specific to some sort of proteins.
Right. I would say another set of sort of translation errors, if you will, is frame shifting. And that can be used for both adaptive evolution in certain viruses, as well as have negative consequences. And in yeast, they can regulate that. There's a prion that can switch you from being, not a frame shift, but a read through of a stop codon. There's prions that can cause you to read through a stop codon or not. I'm getting off topic, but it's a great question. Yeah, Emmanuel. Yeah, so I think, so the question was how drastically, and I'm sorry for not repeating the questions earlier, but as Shelley has advised me. So the question was how much would a point mutation change expression level? And I think the idea, if I'm following this correctly, is that you have compensatory mutations in a promoter. So it's not, the underlying assumption isn't that the point mutation would change the expression level. The model is the point mutation would change the biochemical activity, the KCAT or Vmax of an enzyme, if you will, but that's made neutral. The net effect of that mutation is also going to be coupled to promoter changes that can up the expression level or decrease. The output, the biochemical output, would be expression level times activity per molecule. Right, exactly. And the observation that a promoter change, that if increasing the expression level of the protein is the cost of that is just due to the expression level. If you have a protein that's expressed at a low level, you're more likely to get a neutral mutation that doubles its expression, for example, than for a highly expressed protein. If you double its concentration or expression level, it has a much more strong expression cost. Yeah, let's maybe come back to this because I think it's a really important point it'll come back in the slides. Okay, so the other hypothesis, which I think most of you or some of you have digested by now, is that and this was put forth by Alan Drummond in a very amazingly highly cited, very influential paper. So this has been cited over 450 times, and it's a I think a very tribute to both how well it's written and how sort of knew the idea was at the time, and that was that selection for quality control, in that if you may have a real big impact on this observation that expression level correlates with mutation rate or evolutionary rate of proteins. So the insight was that translation errors occur at a frequency where if you think about a protein, for example, a protein that's highly expressed that has 100,000 copies per cell, and in yeast that's a highly expressed protein. If you have an error rate of what's been measured biochemically, it's about 1 in 5,000 per amino acid, and you have a protein of about 500 amino acids, 10% of those are going to have some error due to translation. And if you have 100,000 molecules in the cell, it means you have 10,000 molecules that have an error from translation. So if those cause folding defects, or stress on the cell in some way, they could be subject to selection, and that selection should be stronger on the more highly expressed the protein is, because there would be more copies of a problematic protein in the cell. So there's been a number of really nice studies trying to quantify what expression cost is. And I should also point out that if I don't say it explicitly, everything that I'm talking about in this presentation is about Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which I firmly appreciate that it's a model system and may not apply perfectly to every other creature in the universe. But I just want to make that clear. These are numbers that are relevant or come from studies of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So there's a very nice paper exploring how overexpression of every open reading frame in yeast impacts many different features, one of which being the growth rate of yeast. And one of the analyses from this is looking at how the growth rate of the yeast, which is a proxy for fitness, or it's a measure of experimental fitness under the conditions of the experiment, that if you fit this, if you fit the protein length to the observed growth effect, of course you can see there's a lot of noise, but the information content from having, presumably having lots of different measurements will, the average value or the slope of this will have some meaning. And it indicates that the cost of synthesizing a single amino acid is on the order of 10, is about 10 to the minus 10 in a yeast cell under rich growth conditions. So that's relevant and relates to another study, which also comes from Alan Drummond, which examined what do you see as a cost of expressing a protein that has a span of mutations in it that affect its ability to fold and its propensity to aggregate. So when you have mutations that increase the aggregation propensity, you get a decrease in the growth rate. And if you, in the case of the most misfolded one, they saw about a 4% growth defect. Yep. Yeah, I think that's a great question. There could be multiple factors that influence it, so influence the cost that comes out of this. It could be that, for example, if you overexpress the protein, there could be concentration-dependent factors, as we were talking about earlier. So it's possible that it has, in fact, not just the cost of expressing the protein, but disturbing the cellular stasis that's there, the cellular, I don't want to say equilibrium, but the cellular fluxes that are there, and displacing those could have toxic effects. So this should be looked at as probably as a upper estimate, if you will, or a bounded estimate. Similarly, this cost that comes out over here, so there's also an expression cost of expressing, it's GFP in this case. If you express wild-type GFP, that also has about a 1% growth rate defect at this expression level, and that comes out to about 10 to the minus 9th fitness cost per amino acid. But that number also is also going to be a bounded estimate, because GFP itself has a tendency to aggregate and can form interactions with other proteins, weak binding events that may also disrupt cell physiology. So those are all good points. Okay. So these are, I think, really valuable at sort of highlighting some of the issues people have thought about in terms of purifying selection. And one of the things that I became interested in was thinking about how specific amino acid changes influence this. So these experiments from the Drummond lab, for example, were with engineered variants of GFP that they identified to be temperature sensitive and found that they had these properties of being aggregation prone. I was interested in a more general scheme of asking, how deleterious is the span of amino acid changes that you could make in a protein, and to try to infer from that type of data what some of these characteristics may be, what some of these relationships may be. And so coming back to these models of evolution, if you're in the red region, it's going to be very difficult to understand or appreciate or investigate the strength of mutation, the strength of a deleterious mutation, from looking at patterns of sequences in species or in individuals or species that are currently around. And the reason for that is, if you're deleterious, And that means if you're just outside the near neutral window, if you have proportional to the inverse of the effective population size, if you have an effect on fitness that's greater than that, you're going to be purged from the population rapidly. So you're not going to see those alleles or those mutations at appreciable frequency. So for example, the effective population size of Saccharomyces paradoxus is estimated at around 10 to the 7th, which means that a 1 in 10 million effect on growth rate in S. paradoxus should have been fairly efficiently purged from populations. And so, but on the other hand, if you have something that's a null allele, you're also going to be purged pretty efficiently. So in order, if you want to see these mutations in a population, you have to sequence a lot of individuals. That'll allow you to see the weakly deleterious mutations. Okay. So the approach that we've, I'll tell you a little bit more that my lab's been pursuing, is to make systematic mutations in a protein sequence and try to set up experiments that allow us to quantify how those affect growth rate of yeast as a proxy for fitness, as well as experiments to and simulations to try to understand how those mutations affect biochemical activity, a direct readout of biochemical function, and ultimately how those then are can be interpreted in terms of structure. Okay, so the hero in this story really is a grad student in my lab. One of the first grad students to join my lab was Ryan Hippus. And you know, he had a very different project than this. He was going to study using biochemical approaches how HSP90 mechanism works, how it binds to ATP, how it hydrolyzes it, which I think are also fascinating questions. But we had, at this point, there was a faculty meeting that was fabulous, and this project really came out of that. So there was a presentation from a colleague of mine at UMass describing how affordable deep sequencing was. So this was in 2008, and it was, you know, it wasn't as widely used as it is now, and it was sort of eye-opening to realize actually I could fit in my budget 8 sequencing runs. Like I had that much left in my startup, so I was like, okay, cool. We should at least, you know, figure out what we might be able to do with this. And so the idea that Ryan and I sort of mapped out was, okay, we'd like to know where important regions in this protein are. You know, maybe we can do it by just making all the possible point mutations in the protein and then use sequencing to measure the frequency of them. And yeah, this, you know, we can try it. So the concept is quite simple. Make a library of mutations, of engineered mutations, put them into an engineered yeast cell where we can put in a concerted effort, put strong selection on the library variant of the gene, and ask over time, how does the frequency of each of those mutant alleles change over time?
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you replacing the endogenous allele with your engineered allele?
Essentially, I mean, we play some yeast tricks to make it work out. There's lots of different ways to do it. The experiments I'll tell you about today are using a shutoff approach. So we make a conditional strain, and then we rescue it with a constitutively expressed plasmid version.
And all the library variants are competing together?
That's right. So they're all in the same physical flask, and that's valuable because it enables each cell to experience essentially identical in a well-mixed flask environmental conditions. Yeah. Yep. And Ryan also was sort of had a passion for the English language, so he came up with a backronym that seemed nice, which was empiric, that sort of gave you know, both intuitive ring, because what we're doing is really experimentally testing how mutations work, but he was able to fit it into something that made sense in terms of the details of what he was doing. Okay, so I should say other people have come up with a much better term, and that's mutational scanning. and so I'll use those interchangeably, because mutational scanning is a better term. Okay, so there are there's a lot of different technologies that people are using. I'm going to talk a little bit about some ones that we were using in the early days. Things have changed since then. I'm happy to talk to people about more modern approaches if you like. The real reason I wanted to highlight this is that there are, of course, technical challenges with this. And one of the biggest ones is that it's deep sequencing makes errors, and you need to deal with those somehow, or you need to know that your signal is beyond those. And so we were really excited by the first sequencing run that Ryan did, because in black is showing the frequency of mutations in an unselected population, and in pink is showing the frequency of errors from a control reaction of a template that had, to the best of our ability, no mutations in it. And so what's clear is that while there is noise, there are errors. All of the amino acid substitutions, all the codons, in fact, were dramatically higher in frequency than the errors. So we could use this approach then to measure the frequency change of any amino acid or any codon with a lot of precision. We could see things decrease tenfold or a hundredfold with confidence. Okay, so the other thing, as Cassandra alluded to earlier, we need a way to start the race, if you will. So we can put lots of these plasmids into cells, but we need a way of saying, okay, selection starts at this time point, and that's where we're going to start to measure things. So we really need a conditional strain, something that will grow fine under condition A, but then we switch it to condition B, and it only grows if the rescue plasmid or the rescue mutant is functional. And so there are lots of ways of doing this. You don't need to use shutoff strains. You can do it with fluorescent readouts, fluorescently marked plasmids and FACS, for example. But the initial way we did this is we came up with an inducible promoter, and we used reported changes in that promoter that affect its expression level. We found one that matches the endogenous expression level under the on state. And when we turn it off, it goes to undetectable levels. Okay, so this allows us to put all of our plasmids into a strain that's co-expressing on sort of normal level of HSP90, and then across the culture rapidly turn off growth. And so if you do controls with this, cells that don't have a rescue, don't have a functional rescue plasmid, they take about four generations, but then they plateau. Mutations, strains that have a wild-type rescue continue to grow robustly.
These are plasmid-based,
but you can do the same experiments with integration. And we haven't done those yet because it limits your throughput a little bit. What we have done is we have integrated individual mutants into the chromosome to see if there's any difference. We haven't noticed anything big. It doesn't mean that there's not exceptions, but it means that in general, the plasmid fitness effects are mimicking integrated results for, say, 10 mutants. Yeah. Okay. So the types of readouts that we get in the end are time on one axis and a frequency change on the other axis. And we can see in later Ryan got that, for example, there's lots of null alleles. We have lots of stop codons. We have stop codons at every position. Those rapidly drop off. Of course, there is a place where we start to run into noise, so we can't watch them for very long. We can also see synonymous or silent substitutions persist in a culture, and they tend to persist at the same frequency relative to the parental nucleotide sequence. If we change the environmental conditions, we can see mutations that increase relative to wild type that are adaptive to a non-standard condition.
What are the units now?
Sorry, these are hours. Yeah, and the generation time is about 3 hours for the strain under these conditions. Yeah. And so the drop-off in the stop codon is close to the theoretical. It's not perfect. It's usually about 0.7, apparent selection coefficient 0.7. And we think that that's due to imperfect synchronization across the population. So not all the cells are stopping to growing at exactly 12 hours. And so that we think that's the reason. Yeah. Okay. So if we can look at lots more of this data, for example, by color coding it, and I'll show you some plots of this style where you simply plot in a sort of local heat map representation amino acid space on this side and position in the protein on the other axis. So this is a map, for example, we've generated of scanning mutations across yeast ubiquitin. I'm not going to try to walk through every position or every mutant. I think that would be very tedious. But I will point out at this point, I think that we were fortunate to be on the early side of this. So I really did benefit from that faculty meeting. And I'm very thankful to Phil Zamor, is the faculty member of my department, who was community-minded enough to sort of really want to communicate to us how useful this technology could be. So we were fortunate to be on the early side of publishing. We were the first group to do this in a systematic way where we make every point mutant. But there was a previous really influential paper from Doug Fowler and Stan Fields where they used a very analogous approach. They used random mutagenesis, so they had there's some differences in the types of data, but it was essentially very similar in approach. And then sort of soon after ours, a really awesome paper came out from David Baker's lab where they did a ton of things, including using this type of approach to improve the binding affinity between a design protein and influenza hemagglutinin. And Rama Ranganathan also had a pretty amazing paper the following year. In the last 4 years, there have been over 100 papers using this type of approach. So I would say it's not just something that uniquely works in one lab, but it's quite robust, and it can be applied to a lot of different issues. So if anyone's interested at any time, I'd be very happy. I'm always happy to talk about ideas and helping out in any way that I can, whether it's providing advice or thinking through more collaborative type projects. Okay, so there are some advantages of this, and some of those we alluded to earlier. Cassandra asked about whether things were in the same container. They are. That's actually quite valuable because if you do experiments on individual clones, often the environmental conditions aren't identical. Even if they're in the same incubator, it makes a difference whether you're on the left side or the right side. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why there is some variability in those estimates. In addition, the genetic background is controlled as carefully as we can. So everything goes into cells that have been very recently isolated from an individual colony. So we can very precisely control genetic background. OK, in addition, we can scan for, yeah?
For the spot experimental setup, once you do your selection experiments and discompletion experiments, do you actually go back and resequence the strain to discount additional mutations that you might select in the background?
We haven't done that. There's a few instances where we've been tempted to do it. We just haven't gotten there yet. So for example, when we go for about 20 generations, we've never seen anything but a sort of very consistent growth pattern, meaning if a mutation has, say, a 5% growth defect, it continues to have that over 20 generations. If we go longer, what we see...
Okay.
If we go longer, we do see some things that change trajectory, and hypothesis would be they pick up a secondary mutation somewhere else, but we don't know where or what that would be. Okay, so we can, one of the nice things about this is a lot of the experimental effort is making the libraries. Once you have those, it's pretty easy to transfer them to a different system. And so one of the nice things we'd like to do is we'd like to compare effects on physiological output, say growth rate, with effects on some more physical property, whether it's protein folding or binding to another protein. And so we can do that by using a biochemical selection. For example, we can put a library on the surface of yeast and then use a selection scheme that's biochemical, ability to bind to some other protein, separate out those populations by either just panning on a column or more used, in a more quantitative way by separating them out by FACS analysis. Okay. So that's the technical background. I won't belabor that anymore. I'm going to tell you probably in the time we have some results on HSP90 that I think are relevant to the topics I was introducing earlier, relevant to expression level. And what are the biochemical influences that are really influencing the magnitude of deleterious fitness effects? So the gene that I'll present most of the data about today is HSP90. This is a chaperone in all cells as far as we know it. It seems to have different roles in prokaryotes and eukaryotes. So in eukaryotes, such as Cerevisiae that I'll tell you about, it seems to be critical for activating or maturing kinases. That's an intriguing observation in itself. That's sort of what led me to be interested in studying HSP90 initially. And it's interesting because most of the time, chaperones would be associated with a protein's folding properties and not necessarily a protein's biochemical function. So why is it that the chaperone is highly enriched for kinases and other signaling proteins? I think there's a lot of interesting biology to learn there. Yeah.
Is it known if the kinases that its chaperones are orthologous across different species?
That's not known yet. The only place where it's been systematically looked at is in mammalian cells in culture. And there, if you look at which kinases bind tightly to it, about roughly half bind tightly. And they're spread throughout, if you look at a phylogenetic relationship of kinases, they're spread across the tree. So tyrosine kinases, serine threonine kinases, it doesn't seem to be specific to a certain clade there. But the experiments haven't been done, for example, in yeast yet. They're difficult experiments because it's a biochemical experiment and yeast are difficult to lyse. That's right. No, by binding activity in lysates, but yeah, in vitro.
I see. So are we confident that under stress conditions those are actually the chaperone proteins in vivo?
It's been a messy system to work with, honestly. That's why a lot of the progress on this has been slow. So in vitro, I will say that we and others have tried to recapitulate chaperone activity with purified components. That's been really hard. There's some early studies that have been done, but they use proteins. They use one yeast protein, one human protein, one rabbit protein, one chicken protein, and they work, but they're fairly inefficient. They take hours to activate, whereas kinases, as you know, activate in seconds or minutes in the cell in response to environmental cues. So it's a great question, but one of the intriguing things is that I think there's a lot to learn about both biochemically what this does and then physiologically how that impacts cells. Yeah.
In the human kinases that are recognized, are there any common pathways?
There's not a dramatic correspondence there in terms of pathways. There's a tendency for it to be associated with upstream kinases. So for example, in the MAP kinase pathway, it seems to be more the MAP KKK, which is at the top of that pathway, seems to be more dependent on HSP90 than the MAPK, if that makes sense. Yeah. All right. So we do know some things about it structurally, and these were heroic efforts, I should say. So for about 15 years, I'd say there are about five groups working pretty constantly and pretty diligently on crystallizing this. It's a very flexible protein. Its conformation is very dynamic. It's now been crystallized in two different forms, what's called an open form and a closed form. And the transitions between these appear to be mediated by binding partners. So small molecules, ATP in particular, and then many of the co-chaperones, and presumably the substrates that bind it too. So at this point, I think I did want to point out that at least in my observations, one of the hugest issues or unmet challenges in protein biochemistry is tools and approaches to investigate protein motions. So we see protein structures all the time. I think all of us have seen a tremendous amount of protein structures. And one of the things that I think is really important to appreciate, but very difficult to, is that these representations are hugely informative, but there's another layer of steps for really understanding in detail how a protein mechanistically works that have to do with the motions in the protein. So I wanted to take a quick break in case people hadn't seen this type of movie, just to show you a molecular dynamics simulation. So this is starting from a crystal structure and just asking, how does this protein move over very small timescales, over microseconds? And so one of the things that's absolutely amazing is you see that the entire structure is moving. And so in a handful of systems, people have looked at how these types of motions are influencing the function of the protein. And in enzymes, perhaps this is best understood, or at least for a handful of enzymes. But the amount of motion in the protein is appears to be a critical influence in at least a handful of enzymes that have been looked at. And I'll show you, if time permits, some data from ours that I think suggests, and other labs, that this not only is critical for enzymes and their activity, and you can imagine that, OK, maybe there's some substrate that needs to bind, and there's a motion that needs to be correlated with the substrate in order for it to chemically get over some barrier. But this also appears to be very important for protein binding events, at least in a few examples that I'll highlight later. All right, so. OK. I also wanted to mention, I was really, I enjoyed tremendously the presentations from Sarah and Emmanuel from Wednesday and yesterday, where they really beautifully showed how sticky patches can mediate protein oligomerization. And I'd love to talk with both of them more. And HSP90 and chaperones in general tend to have lots of sticky patches. That's, in fact, part of how they work. They have sticky patches that match up with their substrate sticky patches to make a sort of Band-Aid, if you will, to cover them up. But that Band-Aid only works if you have something, how does HSP90 have all these sticky patches and not aggregate like crazy? So that's sort of an area where I think a lot of, there's room to understand a lot of things. One of the studies we did is in that area is realizing that while hydrophobic amino acids make sticky patches, highly polar and highly charged amino acids tend to make soluble patches, if you will. And in fact, there's two of these in HSP90 that are sort of outstanding. They're unstructured regions that were clipped out to make the crystal structures. There's one in the middle of the protein and one at the end, and they're dramatically enriched in glutamic acids, so E and D. And the observations or the idea we had is that these may be really important for allowing the chaperone itself to be soluble. So at least in the case of this chaperone, that appears to be the case. You take them out, the cells grow, and in experiments I'm not showing here, the protein itself is very aggregation prone. You can rescue them, so it's not, there's no sequence dependence. You can rescue this deletion, charge deletion variant by putting in a charged region from a different protein. So it suggests that there's a balance between the chaperone sticking to its, it has to stick to other substrates, but also it needs a way to rescue itself from being sticking to itself. Okay. So back to this idea of evolutionary rate, where does HSP90 fall on this? It's highly expressed. So there's about 100,000 molecules per cell. And it's also consistent with that, one of the most slow evolving proteins that we know about. It accumulates one amino acid changing mutation for every 10 synonymous changes. If you look at the ATPase domain, and I'll show you data in a minute for a mutational scan of this region, you can see that there's lots of regions that have high entropy. So entropy of 2.5 would be a position where every amino acid is equally sampled across the sequence alignment that we made. Sequence alignment is from diverse eukaryotes. So I realize in this audience, I should have looked up where it was in the supergroups of eukaryotes. But it does vary, at least across plants to humans. And if you're zero on the entropy scale, it means you're fixed. You're only one amino acid across that entire alignment. And if you look at where these amino acid variations map onto the structure, red is showing positions that are invariant, and blue are positions that are highly variable. There's a lot of positions that are invariant. So there's a lot of amino acid conservation. And one of the things that we'd like to know is where are the ones that are really critical versus the ones that may have a minor defect that are subject to natural selection but are maybe not large biochemical effects. And so two really amazing postdocs in my lab took on this project, and they're shown here. It's Parul Mishra and Julia Flynn. Parul's been in the lab for a few years now and is now starting to look for jobs. For those that may know something, I would pass that information along. So again, this is sort of the presentation of all the data. The only thing I really want to point out here is the stop codons are at the top. They're universally depleted. So anywhere you need sequences downstream of this in the protein to function. The other thing I'd point out is there's a proline belt. So this sort of belt in the middle is proline, and that's consistent with the ability of proline to disrupt most protein secondary structures. So proline doesn't fit into alpha helices or beta strands, and that's why we think that it's disruptive in many places in a protein. Okay, so Parul and Julia did a ton of searching for what parameters may explain the sensitivity, fitness sensitivity that they observed. So they looked for stickiness. They looked for effects on protein folding by computer simulation, by predicting the free energy changes of the mutations. And none of those were able to explain more than a small fraction, say 5 or 10% of the variance that we saw in fitness effects. They got a little bit frustrated by that, and they said, okay, well, we're just going to look at the structure and see where things map. And it was really, really clear from that most of the critical positions were really highlighted around ATP. And so they made the analysis that's shown here. They looked at the distance from each atom in ATP to each position, each amino acid position in the protein. And then they asked, how does the average fitness effect, as a measure of how critical that position is, how does that correlate? And as you can see here, if you look at the gamma phosphate, essentially distance from that one atom in ATP explains about half the variance that we're observing in fitness effect. So So that to us, and again, if you map those onto the structure, this is what made it clear to them, was if you just map where a complete defect is versus no defect, you can see that they're all highlighted. The gamma phosphate of ATP is right between this position and this position. This is a region that is known to change conformation structurally when you hydrolyze ATP. Okay, so this, I think, comes back to this idea of protein motions or changes in conformation. Yep.
So ATP binding pocket has these very well conserved regions. So it's PM and GA regions that basically are the substrate binding and the nucleophilic attack residue. If you were to consider every single one of those very conserved positions in proximity to those positions, do you have any different behavior than you have regarding proximity to the gamma phosphate?
So if you did...
Because what I'm asking is, are you just discovering that petrolipid sites are important, or are you discovering something else, which is specific with the gamma phosphate, so the third phosphate that's been catalyzed?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Jose.
Is it generic about petrolipid sites, or is it specific about gamma phosphate?
So it's more than simply the residues that were appreciated to be catalytic that are critical by this analysis. So there's, and in fact, it's more complicated. One of the positions that was thought to be critical actually isn't. So it's more complex than simply the catalytic residues explain everything. But again, I'm not sure if I'm following your question. Maybe I can show another slide, and then if it doesn't address it, ask again. Okay. So one of the positions in HSP90 that's been thought to be critical for a number of years, and in fact was really, really the strongest evidence that showed that HSP90 was an ATPase, which was a debated issue for about 5 or 10 years. There were reports on either side. It's a slow ATPase. It's more like a GTPase. It requires activators to really be efficient. And so until those activators were discovered, this was a real issue of debate. But the strongest experiment supporting it was that even in the presence of activators, if you make a mutation to aspartate 79 to asparagine, so in some ways the most conservative, it's certainly the most closely similar amino acid in terms of shape, you completely disrupt the ability of the protein to function. So it doesn't support yeast growth, it doesn't activate kinases, and those were strong evidence that you in fact need to have this as aspartate in order for this to work. And structurally, this made sense because while it's not catalyzing ATP hydrolysis, it's making a hydrogen bond, a very tight, very close hydrogen bond contact to the adenine ring. And the idea was that the positioning of the adenine ring in this pocket is also going to be critical for hydrolysis. It has to be positioned in a perfect way in order for the reaction to go efficiently. So when we did the screen, of course, or not of course, but one of the things that came up was there were two mutations that seemed to work quite well. So if you replace aspartate with either glutamate or cysteine, we got a protein that enabled yeast to grow reasonably well. And so we, Julia and Pruhl went ahead and made these proteins and tested their biochemical and physiological impacts, because one of the things could be we have some noise in our data. This is simply showing if you make those individually, those mutations grow robustly, indistinguishable from a wild type strain or a wild type rescue in this experiment. And they're also able to hydrolyze ATP in vitro. The cysteine mutation requires an activator protein, but the activator protein is present in cells. So at least to me, this argues that there's aspects of the mechanism, even of the hydrolysis mechanism, that we don't fully understand. But it also highlights that it's really this region of the protein where the gamma phosphate is that's hypercritical. So the correlation to distance from the gamma to where this binds is much less. So there's lots of mutations that support the idea that the precise orientation of how the ATP is binding in the pocket is not that influential.
The different mutations, if you model what is the specific effect on the little slide, are these ones most likely to cause, say, steric hindrance compared to others? Or do you actually pursue this avenue? Because there's obviously a result, which is why.
Yeah. So we have, throughout the structure, done delta-delta G calculations. And those don't correlate very well. I think your question is a little more detailed. It's asking, is it disrupting the ATP? Is it disrupting the phosphate? I think we have a lot more work to do there. So what we've done so far, I think, is scratching the surface. But it says so far that steric ideas, they don't explain a lot of the data. They're insufficient. And I think part of that is because the protein relaxes. So as you make a mutation that you say might sterically not fit, what happens, I think, is that the protein is adjusting so that it does sterically fit. The backbone may be shifting. And that's something that's very difficult to model. That comes back to this idea of protein dynamics and how does the protein adjust to something like a steric change. I will say, I think it was hopefully clear from the earlier descriptions, but the picture or the image that you get when you look at conservation across a phylogeny is very different than the picture you get when you look at experimental sensitivity. And again, I think all these, what the conservation pattern is telling us is that there's lots of positions that have an influence on fitness. They may be small, but they're relevant relative to the neutral window. Whereas this picture is telling us really sort of what's critical on a gross level for activity and function. Okay. So another way, I think, of sort of summarizing this or sort of take-home message, if you will, is that if you have, if you look at the conservation in this plot up here versus sensitivity to mutation, what you can see is that positions that are poorly conserved, so they're very highly diverged, there's a lot of predictive value, at least in terms of experimental effects. So if you're tolerating substitutions in the natural record, those are positions that are very tolerant to substitutions experimentally. So the, for example, the 20 most divergent positions in our sequence alignment all tolerated almost every amino acid substitution. The converse is really a poor prediction. So if you have a position that's fully conserved, it's really difficult to understand or predict what the effect is going to be biochemically. So you see positions that are critical. So here's a position that can only be one amino acid. But you also see positions that tolerate the majority of amino acid substitutions. So this is sort of a, maybe for us was very counterintuitive. Maybe to this crowd makes a lot of sense. But I think this still comes back to this idea that natural evolution is going to purge mildly deleterious as well as strongly deleterious mutations. You're not going to observe them in a sequence alignment.
You modify conditions to take away. I mean, the obvious interpretation of that is that if you change conditions, that a lot of these will fall away.
Yeah. So we have looked at conditions. Of course, one can always say you haven't looked at enough conditions. There is change with conditions, but I would say the most surprising thing to me was the small number of changes with changing environmental conditions. So most mutations stay relatively the same. That's both in HSP90 and in ubiquitin, where we've now looked at, say, you know, five or six different environmental conditions.
The feature of conserved mutations being unpredictable, does it hold when you stress cells?
Yes, so we've done these experiments at elevated temperature and elevated salinity, and they for HSP90, and they hold. We've done it for ubiquitin under a whole host of different stresses as part of a boot camp at UCSF for grad students. And again, there are changes. There are, you know, I would say more on the subtle side changes than on the dramatic side. You get a better, so we've gotten improved fits to this type of data using like the blow sum matrix than we have using delta G predictions from Rosetta. So I think that speaks to, it also may speak to this system being particularly sensitive to protein motions that are not being incorporated. So we're not using Rosetta with backbone motion. We haven't tried that, and that's an obvious next step. So we need to do that, but yeah.
Could some of it have to do with like pairs interacting things, whether in the protein or the protein or something else? The question, one substitution gives you an effect, but if you had two together, then you wouldn't have an effect, you know, or the opposite.
So we have taken a look at epistasis within HSP90. We're at the early stages, and so I'm not, I would otherwise present it here, because it's sort of a really, I think, an interesting way of looking at it. What we have done is looked in detail among the recent yeast relatives through an ancestral reconstruction approach, where we've gotten collaboration from Joe Thornton and Tyler Starr in his lab, really. And so we've asked, how do there's 140 mutations that seem like they've occurred in this lineage. When you make them, you find that they have a very modest, on average, defect on the order of 1%. So it suggests that there is some epistasis going on, but it's generally weak. There's one strongly epistatic site, and we were able to, from the ancestral reconstruction, pick out there seems like there's a secondary substitution that rescues it, that rescues it. So it does look like there is some covariation, but that doesn't seem to explain the majority of things. Could it be covariation with other, say, kinases evolving, co-evolving? That also doesn't look like it's the case. So we've reconstructed the ancestor, which should have interacted with a very different genetic background of kinases as well as co-chaperones, and that functions very well to our experiments, indistinguishable from the yeast HSP90. So it suggests that the function is fairly well conserved, at least to the resolution of our experiments. Yeah.
What are the limits on the sensitivity measure? Because I mean, this is a standard problem, like knockouts that, you know, they're still alive, and so what's the big deal? But as you pointed out, in nature, the minimum selective coefficient for the operands, something down around 10 to the minus 7.
Yeah.
I doubt you can detect things that small in these kinds of experiments.
So, yeah, so the...
How good are you down to, about 10 to the minus 3? Or?
On a good day, with a lot of sequencing depth, we can get to 10 to the minus 3, and we judge that by doing a full experimental replicate. That may be a harsh judge, because there can be genetic differences between the replicates and experimental differences as well, because they're in separate flasks. But I think that's our limit. So it's a really good question, sort of how does the resolution compare to the resolution of natural selection? We're nowhere close. We're orders of magnitude for most species away from that resolution. And so that's a question of how well can you extend them to natural evolution, I think is a really relevant question. I'd say more what we're doing is distinguishing the rough space of deleterious mutations, but we're not close to distinguishing neutral or near neutral.
Yeah. And you can't let the experiments go longer, because I guess you start to get hitchhiking effects, I guess is what you're alluding to.
So, yeah.
Because that would give you more sensitivity, but
yeah,
you're picking up other background mutations.
Yeah. So we have thought about doing some much longer term experiments, but then the questions that you start to ask become very different, because you start to, yeah. Yeah.
So this is not a question about this, but second mutation in the same colon. This idea of neutral networks, by definition, zero sensitivity, but if you're at the edge of the network, it might nevertheless be suppressed. Is that something which, I know you can get out of your data, but something in
the way? Yeah, the question's really clear. So we've thought about it, but we haven't done the analysis yet. We're probably not the right people to do that. I've talked to, I'm spacing on the scientist's name, but there's a scientist in Germany who's sort of the leader. Yeah, Andreas Wagner, yeah. So I've talked to a student there. I think they did some simulations on early data sets that were smaller, and I think should go back now that there's a lot more data, and not just our data, but I think one of the things that would be really useful for this area of science is to have a central compilation, not just of our data, but the 100 others. Right now, they're scattered, and I think I'm trying to spark some efforts and contribute to some efforts to get these coalesced into one site so that they can be available for exactly this type of analysis. But yeah, that's beyond what our focus is right now. Yeah, I think that, so there, as far as I know, there aren't experiments that have directly tested, the same mutational scan on the same protein in two different organisms. I think it's a fascinating experiment. We're pursuing a little bit of it with HSP90 using the approaches you alluded to. I think there's the most gain to be looking at, for example, an ancestor or a most likely reconstructed ancestor. Because it looks like a lot of the epistasis is pretty weak. And so I think that if you did the experiment at this resolution in, say, with human HSP90, I think you'd find largely the same patterns. But I think the experiment should be done. It's just sort of, right now our guess based on a lot of indirect inferences is that it's not gonna be super exciting. Emmanuel. Yeah, again, we've done them in a rudimentary way, but they haven't. None of those types of metrics. Solvent exposure is one we've looked at. Contact is one we've looked at. But of course, one of the things that we always keep in mind is that we don't know all of the biologically relevant structures. We know two structures of it, but we don't know it in connection or in binding modes with all of its substrates or co-chaperones, which I think would give the pattern that you're thinking about.
And so, and second question, which is related to what you just said. So, if you take the distance to the gamma phosphate, is there one particular conformation that best correlates? Or
it correlates a lot better, or modestly better, with the protein that's bound to ATP, as opposed to, I mean, with the ADP, we have to model where the phosphate is, but we think we can do that reasonably well. It's about half as good. The loop changes conformation, and some of the really sensitive mutations are in this loop, just where it sort of contacts ATP, and when it hydrolyzes, it flips other direction. There's definitely mutations that cause a large change in the rate of hydrolysis in purified form that have indistinguishable effects on growth rate or activation of kinases. The caveat to that experiment is that in purified form, we know that we don't have all of the partner proteins that we know influence ATPase rate in the native context. So I think to do the right experiment is really hard. I think people are gearing up to it. There's some single molecule work that's coming out of the Hugel lab in Germany, where they're starting to be able to look at, it's pretty amazing, in sort of single vesicles, they can isolate one HSP90, you know, as well as one substrate and different co-chaperones, as well as ATP, and they have three different fluorescent labels. One can be on the ATP, one can be on the client. So I think that those types of studies may be addressable in a more robust way, but right now, it's uncertain. Okay. All right, so these really cover the questions you guys were asking. Variable environmental conditions could impose more stringent selection than laboratory evolution. That's certainly the case from looking at a handful of conditions. I'm not going to run through the data here. But it does appear that those changes tend to be more subtle than dramatic. It's not that we, you know, if we add 100 or 1,000 more conditions, maybe we explain everything. We can't rule that out. So that's something that I think obviously has a big factor. The dependence of fitness on genetic background appears to be relatively minor, but that's also a contributing factor. All of these, I think, are influences that. As Jose was saying, tries to, you know, make sense of this data, of the sort of experimental data compared to the conservation patterns in nature. But the third point, I think, is one that seems just, you know, so striking in terms of the magnitude differences, and this is what Mike was pointing out. We're measuring things on a 1% or 0.1% growth difference, and natural population should be purifying things on a much, much finer scale, orders of magnitude finer.
I'm just curious, if you just ask for like a histogram of essentially like effect sizes of you know, things that you measure, do you have a potential functional form of that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure if this is what you're getting at. You might be getting at the ones that are around neutrality. But if you want to look at the full fitness spectrum, for example, this is what we see for ubiquitin. There's a peak at null. There's also a peak near wild type, although again, our resolution, I'm not calling those, they're certainly not neutral in the evolution, natural evolution sense.
Presumably, I guess the data is not good enough to tell if that's like exponentially decaying or something else.
At the adaptive side.
Yeah.
So on the adaptive side, this is a collaboration with Jeff Jensen and Claudia Bank, who are at we used to be at EPFL. Claudia Bank is now moving to Institute of Portugal. But we've done exactly that. So if we shift the conditions, we can see, actually in HSP90, we see lots, 10 or 12 mutations that are better than the parental sequence under elevated salt conditions. And so that's been really intriguing for a number of reasons. One of which to me was that you have an essential protein that seems to be, you know, non-adaptive by and large, but it has adaptive capabilities. I think there's some reasons why that doesn't happen in nature. So the Wagner group, Andreas Wagner, has done salt adaptation in yeast. They don't find mutations in HSP90, so it doesn't happen during a natural accumulation period. I think one of the reasons for that is the salt adaptive mutations are recessive. And so, in fact, even if you do it in a, these are details that I sort of skipped for convenience sake. But there's two copies of the HSP90 gene, even in a haploid yeast. So there's a constitutively expressed version and an induced version. And I think that it would, based on the results we have, even if you express one of these adaptive mutations at fivefold excess, which is mimics sort of if it occurred in the constitutive version, it's not sufficient to give you a salt adaptive. They're really, really recessive. Suggests that there's a loss of some subfunction that's really driving it. So this comes back to the points that I think that Shelley was making in her talks. You know, experimental evolution seems to go by loss of function mutations, and natural evolution seems to come by maybe predominantly gain of function substitutions. You know, in the sense of time, I think I'm just going to skip forward to my acknowledgments. I'm happy to talk more about any of these things at any time, but I definitely, as Mike said earlier, I shouldn't feel a pressure to fill a full hour and a half, and so I'm gonna take Mike at his word. I will maybe say a brief thing if people have the patience to say that there's a lot of we've done a lot of work on cost. We've done some work on cost benefit analysis, and we varied the amount of HSP90 in yeast and asked how well they grow. And their benefit function really looks like this. So the wild type is on this amazingly long plateau on an experimental scale. And this is one reason why we get bimodal fitness effects. So I think I showed you the ubiquitin profile. And the idea being if you have if you have a biochemical distribution that's, say, unimodal like this, if most of those mutation effects fall on this plateau, they're gonna cluster at wild-type like fitness when you look at the regime. So this is actually an idea that goes back about 70 years to Kaxer and Burns. And I think this is, in terms of understanding mechanistically what happens, I didn't want to tell you this story. It's published. You can read about it if you like. But this is hugely influential in trying to make sense of the data we have. Yeah, and so there's a fabulous paper by Kaxer and Burns from 1980 or 1981 called The Genetic Basis of Dominance, which I would definitely recommend to people who haven't taken a look at it. And it really explains how this has widespread effects. For example, it explains why most null mutations are going to be recessive in a diploid. Even if you're in an essential protein, most of the time you can reduce the function, the net level of function by twofold without having severe consequences. Of course, there are exceptions. There are proteins that are dominant. There are disease states where if you lose half function, you have a strong consequence. But if you look across the experiments that have been done in microbes as well as mammals, it does appear that most null alleles are recessive. Okay, so I was ambitious. I put together a lot of slides. I will say that I think we're in a very rich discovery phase in biology, just to sort of conclude up. And we have these amazing visualizations, for example, of how cells work, or some cells work. We don't have a full description, as has been pointed out here, of the diversity of how different cells you know, either look or work. But even for the most well-understood systems, we can't predict how most molecular changes will affect physiology. So we're at a stage where we have a tremendous, I think we're poised to do tremendous things in science. We have you know, plethora of really valuable information. But I think there's a lot of limits in our fundamental understandings of mechanisms, as well as diversity across different animals or different creatures. And so I know I'm talking to the choir here, but this is a critical time for investment in fundamental science. And this is a message that I think is important to convey at every opportunity that we have as a community. I will thank the folks. I think I pointed out people who did the research I talked to you about. That was mostly Perul and Julia, and Ryan, who did some of the early development work on this project. We have a number of awesome collaborators, and I'll thank you guys again for not just for listening today, but for all the conversations over the past few weeks. Thanks very much.
difficult question, but you know, I'm worried that this idea of separation of experimental timescales from real timescales, if you're saying it cannot be done even for sort of a well-studied protein like this, to make that leap, then certainly for all the other more complicated phenotypes, you have no hope. So is that really what you think, or do you think we're going to come to some?
No, I'm sorry. That's if I portrayed that, that's an, that's not precisely what I meant. What I think is, I think we'll not have an easy way to distinguish a completely neutral mutation or a near neutral mutation from a slightly deleterious mutation. But
yeah, it's like Mike's question about the degree of sensitivity.
Yeah, but there's
rather than some new type of events that can happen at
low. Yeah, but there's some amazing things that I think we can infer from experimental evolution. So one of which is, for example, you know, this is data on the how expression level of HSP90 changes with growth rate. And we can, for example, we can say, okay, well, we have information about this part of the curve. This is where we really, this is really what's driving the fit. We'd like to make some estimations about the wild type level that's way out here. Is this at all reasonable? So one of the things we can do is we can say, for example, okay, well, is this level here under selection? And we've done experiments. It looks like it is. You can, it, you know, you can make yeast that have different levels, and if you go for weeks, they all converge on that level of HSP90 under no stress. So we can say, okay, well, then what's the cost of expression that would give you an optimum here? And does this, if this function makes sense over here, that cost should also make sense. So I think that's the type of analysis. There's lots of ways of trying to make the connections, but you have to be a little bit more complicated in your thought process.
Point out there are not all proteins have the same.
No.
No, right? If you took something which had a more gradual level, you would gain maybe an order of magnitude or more in your sensitivity.
Right, that's true. That's true. So for example, we've looked at a few rival proteins by the same type of study. In influenza, they have a much more one-to-one relationship. And that may be generally true of viruses. I don't know. We're just starting to look into this. But also ribosomes are a main exception to this in bacteria. They have a pretty much, if you reduce the ribosomes by a half, you reduce the bacterial growth rate by a half. So there are proteins or macromolecule systems that have that property. Yep. Sorry, in the front.
Selection is coming from in nature for the conservation equals one. But I was wondering to what extent maybe it's a sort of neutral effect where, you know, in nature you just don't see everything that could be tolerated. I mean, I guess in humans, for example, like when you see a polymorphic site, there are normally just two polymorphisms. And I'm not sure if people think or that that's because only those two polymorphisms can be tolerated versus other sort of population or demographic.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So could the I think maybe to paraphrase and tell me if I'm interpreting it maybe correctly or not. You know, could it be that there are mutations that have been sampled in nature, but they just haven't fixed? Like mutations that may be neutral, but they haven't. We're just not observing them. We haven't sequenced enough to see them. I think that's certainly true in the sense that we haven't sampled all of the mutations that have been sampled in nature. But I would say that the observations that the DN-DS ratio is, you know, is skewed, is suggesting that there's many more silent, that's saying that there's many more silent substitutions that are fixing than amino acid changing mutations. And that's pretty strong evidence that most amino acid changing mutations are deleterious in nature. But yeah, there are certainly going to be, we don't have a comprehensive listing of the amino acids that have been sampled in fixed lineages, or fixed in lineages. It's a good question.
One last question.
Just one question about this guy. If I understand correctly, if you had done your experiment in the zone where expression level would be 0.1 or something, then you would have a much better sensitivity.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is where we did the experiment. The experiments I told you, I didn't go into this, but this is where we did the experiments. Yeah.
Okay, so the experiments are what we did on mushroom oil.
We sensitized, we did the experiments under sensitized conditions. So yeah, analogous to what David was saying is if you could look at a system that's really sensitive, where you change it a little bit and it grows differently, and you can do that with a system that naturally is that way. We did it artificially, so you could argue there could be concentration-dependent effects, there could be concentration-dependent artifacts. There's lots of different caveats here, but we did the correlation to the phosphate came from experiments that were done under limiting amounts of HSP90, where that was done at sort of 100-fold lower concentrations than it normally is in a cell.
Well, it's probably to your advantage if you had done it, you know, higher, but everything, you know, a lot of things would be different.
Yeah.
Although it would affect the activity of the
right. Right, right. I think that's an important point. So if you want to do these types of experiments, depends on what you want to learn about. Yeah. If you want to learn about adaptation, you may want to do it at the normal expression level. If you want to look for things that work better than wild type under some new condition, that's probably the way to set up the experiment. If you want to learn about the magnitude of deleterious effects, you want to sensitize the system. So it depends what types of questions you're asking. I think they're both types of questions are really exciting and important.
So I just want to say one thing before we thank Dan. So because he mentioned Alan Drummond a couple of times, I just wanted to say publicly that you probably saw that Alan Drummond was on our schedule of participants, but unfortunately we got an email from him a couple of days ago, and he's not going to be able to come. So if you were, just so everybody knows that he's not able to come, but he was very apologetic about it. Anyway. So now, let's thank Dan for this.
Thanks.